Hi, I'm Carla Nappi, and this is the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast. Welcome to the channel, and thanks for joining us. I just finished talking with Hillary A. Smith about her book, Forgotten Disease, Illnesses Transformed in Chinese Medicine. This came out with Stanford University Press in 2017. Now, while the book ostensibly focuses on a particular constellation of disease concepts and ideas that are all associated in some way with the term foot qi, it's really about much more than that. So the book uses a history of foot qi in different concepts, different periods, different kinds of literatures, mostly focusing on Chinese history, but not exclusively focusing on Chinese history. What it does is it uses this as an anchor to ground us in a history of Chinese medical concepts, a history of disease concepts, and really kind of a model of what it could be to write a history of disease that doesn't just assume from the outset this progressive narrative where eventually people came to the right answer, right? It was beriberi all along. That's emphatically not what the book does. And in fact, what it's doing is, among other things, helping readers understand what it could be and see what it could be to write a history of disease in, as Hillary puts it, on their own terms, right? So how do we write about Chinese medicine on their own terms? This is one example of how we might do that. It's a very extensive conversation, so I will let you get right to it, but I really hope you enjoy. I hope it's clear that this is a book that's going to be of interest and going to be very useful to teach with, whether or not you are interested in China, whether or not you work in Chinese history. It's really useful, I think, if you are interested in a history of bodies and their transformations and the transformations in how we have understood them, how we understand them today, and how we will understand them in the future. So thanks for listening, and I hope you enjoy. I'm here today to talk with Hillary Smith about her new book, Forgotten Disease, Illness Transformed in Chinese Medicine. Welcome to the New Books in East Asian Studies podcast, Hillary. Thanks so much for writing such an interesting book and also for making time to talk with me about it today.
Thank you, Carla. I'm excited to talk with you.
So, Hillary, could you start by saying a little bit about your background, and specifically, how did you come to work on China and why health and healing in China specifically?
Sure. So a lot of my interest in China really originated in college, as I guess we hope that it will for most students. College really widened my world. I went in thinking that that I wanted to study Latin because I thought every educated person should know Latin, and I'd never had the opportunity to study any languages other than French or Spanish in high school. But when I got there, I realized that they also had Chinese. And so I forgot about Latin, and I decided to sign up for modern Chinese, and just loved learning the language. And, you know, the more I learned about the language, the more I learned about history and culture. And then my interest in history of science and history of medicine came a little bit later. I actually only took one history class in college, and that was in the last semester in college, but it was an amazing history of biology class with a great professor, Angela Krager. And that class really kind of opened my eyes to the possibility of looking at science humanistically, which really appealed to me. And so talking to Professor Krager, she told me that actually there was such a thing not only as history of science, but history of science in East Asia, because she knew I was interested in China and Chinese language. So I started just reading as much as I could about that field, went to China and taught in China after graduation. And then was very fortunate to study in a couple of departments of history of philosophy, history and philosophy of science, and history and sociology of science, that allowed me to kind of look at science both humanistically and comparatively. So thinking of China in comparison with Western science and medicine. And so I've always been interested since that time in kind of exploring ways of understanding the world and understanding the body and health that make my own way of thinking about those things seem strange. So that's sort of how I came to the kinds of work that I do and the kinds of research that I'm interested in.
Great, thank you. So the book that we're talking about today examines the evolution, and by you're very clear in the book that by evolution you don't mean progress, right? And we'll talk about that because that actually winds up being really important. But the book looks at the evolution of a Chinese disease concept, foot qi, from its documented origins in the fourth century to the present day. Now, as the book shows, and as we'll talk about, I'm sure, over the next hour, the term foot qi has meant very, very different things in different places and times, and that's an important part of the story. Okay, Hillary, so how did you come to foot qi as a focus for your work? Why this particular disease concept?
Right. So I came to be interested in foot qi because I was interested in changes in nutritional knowledge and changing understandings of nutrition and sustenance. And in the sort of typical story of the history of nutrition science, one really big moment is the advent of the idea of the nutritional deficiency disorder. That is that, you know, lacking vitamins in your diet can disable or kill you. And that's a late 19th, early 20th century idea. And it's one that historically was created through the study of beriberi, a vitamin B deficiency. And beriberi was a big scourge in particularly East Asia, but also around the world in the late 19th century. Since that was the time when germ theory was very important, there were all of these investigations to try to figure out what was the germ that was causing beriberi, and they came up with something like 18 different germs that caused beriberi before realizing that it actually wasn't caused by a germ, but was caused by a deficit of a micronutrient of vitamin B in the diet. And so this typically is seen as a big step forward in nutritional knowledge. And I thought, well, wouldn't it be interesting to see what the history of beriberi looked like in China? Now, the translation for beriberi in modern Chinese is foot qi, is jiao qi. And foot qi has a long, long history in classical Chinese medical texts. So I started this thinking that I was going to write this history of beriberi, i.e. foot qi, in China. But as soon as I started the project, I realized that my understanding was very naive and that wasn't going to work. I started talking to people in China, in the PRC, who had a very different understanding of what foot qi was than beriberi. They thought it was athlete's foot. So that was sort of puzzling to me. And then when you read the primary sources about foot qi earlier than the 20th century, it's very clear that it can't really be understood just as beriberi. And so so the project became more of a meditation on how to write about Chinese disease concepts over time than about sort of the development of nutritional science or ideas in nutrition. And I really think the book is about more than just this one disease, than foot qi. Foot qi, I think, is really representative of a lot of diseases in Chinese medicine. So a longitudinal history of it is a good way of kind of orienting ourselves to some big changes in Chinese medicine in general over the course of imperial history.
Absolutely. And one of the things that I really appreciated about the book is the way it uses foot qi as kind of an anchor and a case study to tell a much larger story about how, I mean, in a way, how we understand and tell histories of disease concepts, not just in China, but in other times and places as well. And so the book, and I should say this right at the outset here at the beginning, I think this would make an amazing textbook. And by textbook, I mean kind of an assignable book for use in courses for undergraduates and graduate students, because it gives such an amazing and pointed and a very kind of usefully critical history of Chinese medicine as an exemplar also of what it can be to do a history of disease while it's telling the story of Jiaoqi. So I don't know if you wrote this with that kind of a goal in mind, Hillary, but I think this is going to be a book that's not just great to read, you know, to learn about this stuff and for scholars, but also to teach with.
Oh, thank you. Yes, that is very much one of the hopes that I have for the book.
So this book started as a dissertation, is that right?
It did,
yes. So let's talk about that transformation. Did anything, or what was the transition like? Did anything importantly change for you, either in terms of the way you were structuring the project and or the way that you were conceptualizing the major goals of the project?
It did change for me, and it's actually very much connected to what you've just said about, I hope, its usefulness as perhaps a textbook or a sort of book for a more general readership. I think when I finished the dissertation, it was much narrower and more tentative than the book that it became, and between the dissertation and the book, I had years of teaching experience, which really helpfully kind of broadened the scope of the questions that I was asking, because it made it clear to me what kinds of things students knew and didn't know, and what kinds of questions they really were interested in. And I became interested in those questions too. So it helped me kind of reframe the book a little bit more broadly, in a way that I hope will connect with undergraduates and with people who aren't already specifically interested in the history of Chinese medicine, but you know, perhaps are interested in the history of public health or the history of medicine globally. So, that was one of the ways in which it changed between when I completed the dissertation and the book manuscript.
So we've already talked about the fact that the book uses Fuqi as a case study to do a much more capacious kind of work, both kind of historiographically and methodologically, about history of disease in China, but also in general. So let's get right into that, because that's very much something that the introduction to the book opens out into. So one of the persistent concerns of the book is how we approach the translation of historical disease terminology and concepts. So as you tell us in the intro, there's an officially sanctioned translation of Fuqi that equates it with vitamin deficiency disorder beriberi. And you talked a little bit about the genesis of your own book and how you came to this topic, right? And it seems like that was also part of your process, right? And it makes sense, because that's what a lot of the literature does. But right. The book argues, and this is in the words of the book, that we need a more satisfactory way to approach pre-modern Chinese diseases, and one that gets away from understanding historical disease concepts by asking, for example, what was Fuqi really in different times and places? So Hillary, how did this become such a central concern of the book? And can you talk about this a little bit for listeners who may not be familiar with the field?
Sure. One of the ways in which it became a central focus of the book was just my own kind of difficulty or frustration in explaining to people what the book was about, right? When you introduce it as being about one particular Chinese disease concept, Fuqi, the immediate question is always the one that you brought up, what was it really? And so my sense that's not really the question to be asking, and that question itself sort of carries with it this this idea that whatever contemporary biomedical or modern scientific medical understanding we have of a disease is correct, is the right one, right? And all of the ones that preceded it were correct only to the degree that they kind of corresponded to the way that we understand a disease today. So trying to kind of defuse that question or overcome that question in my conversations with people is one of the reasons that it became kind of a central methodological concern. And I draw on here the literature on framing disease that has come out of the history of medicine over the past few decades, considering disease as not just a biological phenomenon. It is surely that, right? But also as something that is defined socially through a social process of diagnosis, and that social process of diagnosis reflects very much the culture and the sort of political and economic circumstances of the people doing the diagnosis. And so I wanted to apply that framing disease approach to a Chinese disease concept, which is a context that it hasn't really been used in very much before.
Right in the introduction, we also read about another major goal of the book, or at least a goal of the book, right? So the book also destabilizes narratives about disease and imperialism. And I think anybody who has been reading in the field of the history of disease and medicine may be familiar with this persistent concern, right? And so Hillary, what can you talk about that a little bit? What is important for you to destabilize or offer a critical perspective on or move away from in terms of the way the field has related disease and imperialism in the historiography?
Sure. So one of the common ways of thinking about disease outside of the West in the late 19th century has been to think about the non-Western world as being afflicted by all sorts of diseases, nutritional deficiencies, infectious diseases, kind of from time immemorial, or at least since the agricultural revolution in the Neolithic period. And that then in the late 19th century, when Western doctors and public health officials came along with new and cutting edge understandings of disease and ways of treating it, that they began to relieve some of that timeless burden. But more recently, historians have been a little bit more critical of that narrative, and have pointed out that in fact, the expansion of Western power around the globe also brought a lot of disease to places outside of the West, and expanded the geographical area of disease where it had previously been more locally confined. And so in the way that this relates to my book, to Forgotten Disease, is that beriberi, nutritional deficiency disorders in general, and particularly vitamin B deficiency disorder, has often been talked about as an affliction of East Asia in particular over centuries and centuries. And the idea was that because people in East Asia subsisted on highly polished rice, that was, and rice contains in the bran vitamin B, but if you polish it really highly, you lose that vitamin B. So the idea was that since people in East Asia had been subsisting on highly polished rice for hundreds of years, they also had suffered beriberi for a long time until Western medicine came along with its ideas of vitamins and was able to synthesize vitamins and supplement diets and sort of relieve that scourge. And this book is arguing that, in fact, widespread beriberi epidemics were really characteristic of the late 19th century and the early 20th century. They were characteristic of a new set of economic relationships and new ways of processing food, and hadn't been kind of a major scourge from time immemorial in East Asia.
Mm-hmm. Great. And we'll actually see that story play out in more detail a little bit later when we get to the later chapters of the book. I think it's a really fascinating case study that also really usefully complicates the idea of Fut Chi as Chinese, right? What does that mean? Yes. So, but we have to start from the beginning, and the first chapter does that. The first chapter looks at the fourth century context in which Chinese observers first began to write about Fut Chi. Now, what's really striking here, and this is true throughout the book, is how much the chapters are telling stories. So here in this chapter, you open out into the story of a figure, and here it's a fictionalized figure, but it does the work of, I think, modeling a figure that could have been in this literature in order to orient readers in the time and space of the chapter. So I just want to mark that because as part of the writerly craft of producing a book, it's really striking and I think just really effective and really draws you into the story. So that story winds up focusing on the earliest written record of Fut Chi that survives today. And this is from Ge Hong's Emergency Formulas to Keep Up Your Sleeve. This is a kind of home first aid manual. And it's such a fascinating text that Hillary, could you open us into this story by saying a little bit about this first mentioning of Fut Chi and what's special about this, right? What do we need to know about this particular context in order to understand the importance of the changes that are going to follow?
Sure. One of the things that is interesting about this earliest mention of Fut Chi that still survives is that it's not in a highly theoretical text. It's in this little handbook, Ge Hong's Emergency Formulas to Keep Up Your Sleeve, that really is meant for home treatment, self-treatment, and it suggests in the way that it talks about Fut Chi that this is kind of a colloquial term that is in common usage. So Ge Hong, when he introduces the concept of Fut Chi, he doesn't do the thing that that Chinese writers typically do when they're introducing a new term or an exotic term, which is to give kind of the etymology and the meaning of it. And so it seems like it was something that people had a general kind of colloquial understanding of. And Ge Hong is trying to offer some ways of dealing with it that you can do at home, right? And so that's the part of why you mentioned the kind of fictionalized account of the Fut Chi sufferer at the beginning of this chapter. Part of why that was necessary is that, you know, the sort of paucity of the sources in this early period, and also that they're not really sources like the Yellow Emperor's Inner Canon. They're not really formal theoretical sources. They're really kind of the nuts and bolts of how do you identify this disorder that you have, and then what are some methods that you can use to treat it? And so then I sort of applied those suggestions to this fictionalized case. And one of the things that I think this early mention of Fut Chi shows us is that it was considered, like lots of other diseases in this period, kind of peculiar to the South. And this was a time when lots of Chinese aristocrats, the Chinese elite, were moving south into the Yangtze River area. And they were encountering there lots of different ailments that they weren't used to from the north. And one of them was Fut Chi. So I had mentioned at the beginning of our conversation that I think Fut Chi is not, it's not completely unique. It's really representative in a lot of ways of diseases in Chinese medicine. And this is one of the ways it's in which it's representative. It's one of these diseases that is marked as kind of southern for these new immigrants.
Great. Thank you. Now, as we move from this chapter to the next chapter, we move into the 7th century. And it's actually a really different kind of a context. And the texts that Fuchi is discussed in are importantly different from this handbook by Gohong that we were just talking about. Now, chapter 2 shows how healers and patients in the 7th century disagreed actually about the causes, the symptoms, and the appropriate treatment of Fuchi, and talks about the consequences and the nature, right, and significance of those disagreements. Now, this chapter looks specifically at two works. One was Chao Yuanfang's Sources and Symptoms of All Diseases, and the other is Sun Simiao's Essential Emergency Formulas Worth 1,000 in Gold. Hilary, what was importantly different about these texts from that of Gohong? And why are those, or what do those differences tell us about the context of the history of disease here?
Yeah, so both of these texts are, they're different from Gohong's because in one way or another, both of them are intended to kind of make a statement about authority and expertise in medicine. So Gohong, back in the 4th century, medicine hadn't really been his main thing, right? He was he was interested in lots of different things. He's known best for his contributions to Taoism, and his formulary seems to have been kind of a side project for him that, you know, he really wanted to help people deal with their illnesses on their own. In the case of Sun Simiao's emergency formulas worth 1,000 in gold and Chao Yuanfang's disease encyclopedia, both of these are kind of making statements about their authors' expertise. So in the case of Chao Yuanfang, he's the head of a kind of editorial team that is putting together this disease encyclopedia on behalf of the Sui government. And so it's sort of the state's claim to comprehensive knowledge about disease in general. And on Sun Simiao's part, Sun Simiao later came to be thought of as the medicine king. I mean, he was I say in the book, the closest thing to a celebrity doctor in the Sui and Tang period. And what you can see in both of these texts is a kind of friction or disagreement between the authors of the text and others about what Fuchi really was and how you can tell that something is Fuchi and what you should do about it. And so these are books in which you start to see the kind of competitive medical marketplace in which literate physicians operated.
Great. Thank you so much. And this is actually a great, when I think about the use of the book in the classroom, this is one of the clearest, most focused treatments of the history of this medical marketplace that I've seen. And so this is a great chapter to teach with. So I think the whole book is great to teach with, but this is a really, really clear account of the nature and significance of this medical marketplace. Now, when we move to the third chapter from this, and there's a whole lot more going on in the chapter that we just talked about that we haven't had a chance to discuss, I'll just flag that for listeners. But we do, you know, we do move on to chapter 3. This moves us into the 10th century, and it explains how the government, in the words of the book, was unusually active in promoting public health and how this government standardized and simplified Fuchi in ways that would really interestingly eventually carry over into modern categories of beriberi. So this chapter is really important for a lot of reasons, but in part, this is important because this chapter is doing work that destabilizes what otherwise might be a very progressive kind of internalist, triumphalist account of the eventual discovery that this was actually beriberi. And instead, this really shows us how to write a story that is about the social, political, cultural context that eventually leads us not inevitably into that place. So it's really, really, really interesting. And I think this is a pivotal chapter, chapter three, for the development of the argument of the book. Now, this chapter focuses in particular on a textual genre that the government fostered. And this is the genre of the official drug formulary. Hillary, what is so distinctive and important about this genre? And what do we need to understand about this in order to understand how this influences what happens with Fucci in this period?
Well, so as you mentioned, the Somme period is a time when the government really took a much more active and kind of interventionist role in a lot of different avenues of life, including public health, than Imperial Chinese governments had any time before or would any time after the Somme. And one of the things that the Northern Song government does is to establish a system of public pharmacies. And Asaph Goldschmidt has written about this in his work in a very illuminating way. But the system of pharmacies ensured that that pre-prepared drug formulas would be available to people who were within reach of the pharmacies. And it seems to have been a relatively extensive system. And that those drugs and the drug ingredients would be relatively affordable to them, even during times of epidemics or times of great demand for those drug ingredients. Now, along with the pharmacy system, the Song government published a series of drug formularies. So there had been drug formularies before. Sun Simiao's book that we just talked about in the previous chapter was a formulary. And what these are basically they're books that describe how to identify what you or someone you love or someone you know is suffering from, and then what the kinds of drug formulas are that will relieve that those symptoms or that condition. But with the official drug formularies, these were tied to the inventory of the pharmacies, and so it made it much easier for many more people to treat themselves, to sort of diagnose and treat themselves using the resources of the state. And this was also the time when woodblock printing was coming into use. And so in addition to the very expensive and relatively inaccessible original versions of the state pharmacy formularies, there were lots of knockoffs and simplifications and abridgments of them that people used. And so what these formularies did was they created almost a kind of dichotomous key for identifying diseases, kind of like you might use to identify a tree today, you know, so does it have swelling or does it not have swelling? And, you know, if your legs are swelling, you go to a certain section, and if they're not, you go to a different section. And then it has sort of finer differentiations of symptoms. And importantly, none of these descriptions of the symptoms required the kind of seasoned expertise of a physician, right? They didn't require the ability to read a pulse, for example, which was kind of the one of the central techniques for a physician in diagnosing a patient. And so there's lots of complaints actually among literate physicians about how the pharmacy formularies are kind of dumbing down medicine. And historians of Chinese medicine have sometimes disparaged this whole period, starting with the Northern Song and into the Southern Song, as the era of pharmacy formulary medicine, when things became kind of rote and too oversimplified, kind of dumbed down. But what's interesting to me is that when it comes to Fucci, the only features of classical knowledge about Fucci that survived the transition into the modern concept of beriberi come from these formularies come from this period of kind of quote-unquote dumbed down medicine, right? And I think what that shows us is how the kind of bureaucratic imperative that was behind the creation of these formularies in the Song Dynasty and the bureaucratic imperative in modern scientific medicine, in which you need kind of stable and universally readable disease concepts in order to communicate among health insurers and hospitals and doctors. I think there's a resonance in those two kind of bureaucratic settings that allowed at least a few of the types of foot qi that were defined in the pharmacy formularies to become types of beriberi. And the types of foot qi that became types of beriberi were wet, dry, and sometimes chongxin, sometimes what I translate as distressing the mind beriberi. And so there is in beriberi something called wet beriberi and something called dry beriberi. And some contemporary physicians also distinguish a kind of beriberi called shoshin. It's actually the Japanese pronunciation of chongxin. This has sometimes been seen as evidence that, oh yes, foot qi really was beriberi because look, they had wet, dry, and chongxin types. But I don't see that as evidence that foot qi really was beriberi, but rather evidence that there's a certain kind of similarity or resonance between these two medical contexts.
And in fact, it's not until the next chapter and the 13th century when foot qi becomes diet related, or importantly, kind of majorly diet related. Right. So this chapter 4, brings us into the 13th century and focuses in particular on a physician who was fascinated with digestion and who created a new form of foot qi that was related to bad diet. So this is really interesting because although we'll see from here on out, in a lot of contexts, not in all contexts, and you mentioned athlete's foot, right? And we'll get to that, foot qi becomes related to diet, the way it's related to diet, it really changes dramatically and differs dramatically. And we see that beginning here. So this physician was Li Gao or Li Dongyuan. And his theory was really more focused on human habits than on environmental conditions, right? So if the previous accounts of foot qi were about regional differences, right? There was a lot of southern miasmas, and a lot of it was about the environment, environmental qi. He's really focusing on what we are doing that's causing changes to our bodies, what we're putting into our bodies. And he helps distinguish, though, a distinctive northern type of foot qi. So we still have this kind of a regional distinction here in foot qi, but here he's making it very diet related. Now, according to Li, northerners get foot qi because, and this is a quote from the book, they regularly consume kumis and drink without moderation. So for him, foot qi, right, becomes a disease of excess. So for you, Hillary, and we don't have a whole lot of time to talk about this chapter, but is there anything that's particularly interesting about this physician and this source for you when we think about how to situate this in this longer history of this disease concept?
Yes, I think Li Gao, I think, is really fascinating. One of the reasons that he's fascinating to me is that his idea about an internally caused form of foot qi, before the idea had been, you have wet qi coming up into your body from the ground, and that's what causes foot qi. And Li Gao comes along and says, yes, that is one way of getting foot qi, but also in the north, where you don't have that same kind of pernicious wet qi in the ground, you can also get it by, as you said, drinking too much, or particularly kind of dairy things like kumis, eating too much rich and fatty foods. So this is kind of a dietary idea of causation for foot qi. And of course, what foot qi later becomes when it becomes beriberi is a dietary disorder. But historians of Chinese medicine haven't talked about Li Gao very much when they talk about the history of Fuqi, because his understanding of the kinds of dietary problems that cause this is so different from the modern understanding of what causes beriberi, that it's a lack of something rather than overindulgence, which is what Li Gao points to. And it seems to be sort of different people who are afflicted by this type of Fuqi. So one of the things that's interesting to me about Li Gao is that you might expect in a kind of progressivist narrative about Fuqi that this moment would be highlighted or celebrated as, oh, finally, somebody understands it's diet related, right? But in fact, because Li Gao's understanding is so different, and probably the disease that he was observing was probably, in fact, not beriberi, it gets kind of ignored in the broader history of Fuqi typically.
So as we move from this really fascinating case to the next chapter, we look at the social and economic conditions that turned this new dietary disorder that we just talked about into, in the words of the book, the most prominent form of the disease in late imperial China. Now, there are two patterns that you mark here in 16th and 17th century medical literature that represent important transformations or new ways, different ways of understanding this Fuqi concept in this period and context. On the one hand, Fuqi is increasingly thought to be recurring or chronic and diet related. And also at the same time, it's transformed from a primarily regional to a universal disorder. Hillary, why are these transformations so important? Or these new, different ways of understanding Fuqi so important and so importantly different from what had come before?
Yeah. The change in thinking about Fuqi from thinking of it as something that that could kill swiftly. Some of the earlier sources, like in Chao Yunfang and Sun Simiao, warn that that Fuqi can kill you in a matter of days or a matter of months. Here, the emphasis on its sort of lethality drops away. And in these 16th through 19th century sources, in which you have a really important new set of sources to kind of reveal what people are suffering when they have Fuqi, which is case histories. So in the 16th century, you start to get a specialized literature of case histories, and in that you get a bunch of cases of Fuqi. So what stands out in these case histories of Fuqi is that it is written about as something that people suffer from over the course of decades, over the course of a lifetime, repeatedly, and not as something that kills them swiftly, but as something that recurs periodically, and that they need to learn how to manage with drug formulas or with other techniques. And so you start to get all of these new drug formulas in the late imperial literature with these very revealing names like pinching out the pain decoction or spring in your step pills or things like leg replacement pills or flying steps of an immortal powder, which really kind of make it clear that the symptom that most people are most bothered by and are looking to relieve is pain, and often in the lower legs and the feet. And so how do we explain this change in the literature? And by the way, this is another change that has been essentially ignored in histories of Fuqi in the past, which tend to identify things in kind of the early and medieval sources about Fuqi that look like beriberi, and then to ignore the late imperial literature because it doesn't match. It doesn't make sense as beriberi. So to explain these changes, I mean, one possibility of course, is that they reflect a change in the actual epidemiology, that maybe lots more people than before were suffering from chronic pain disorders of the limbs, maybe something like gout or arthritis. A lot of these sources seem to resonate with ideas of gout or arthritis, although, you know, I sort of throughout the book, I'm resisting the idea of connecting this disease with a contemporary biomedical definition. So that's one possibility, is that there's a change in the actual epidemiology. And particularly the late Ming, when a lot of these case history books were being written, this was a period known for rising standards of living and increasing opulence and indulgence. And it might be that those kinds of economic changes did set the stage for an increase in what today we might call diseases of affluence. Or it could be that by articulating concerns about indulgence, literate doctors were expressing their anxiety about economic changes, about the kind of increased social fluidity of the period and new sources of wealth and power. And these new sources of wealth and power sometimes kind of trumped the prestige and security that had been offered by scholarly activity in the past. So it might be either or both of those things converging to explain these changes. And then the second change that you mentioned about the kind of regional understanding of foot qi, this is a period when some writers, and typically these were those with higher social and political status, they were rejecting the idea of regionally bounded forms of foot qi that had been really common and continued to be common in that time. And also of regionally appropriate therapies, because apparently it had become quite common to divide foot qi into a northern and a southern type, the northern type caused by overindulgence and the southern type by that pernicious environmental qi. And it had been common for local healers to recommend kind of regionally specific kinds of treatments, meaning strong purgatives in the north and more kind of gentle replenishing drugs in the south. But these doctors who rejected that kind of regional identification wanted to claim a universal applicability for what they did. And so they started to argue that, well, you can contract either external or internal foot qi, either in the north or in the south. Right. And a good doctor needs to know all the manifestations and treatments and not just kind of adhere blindly to one regional form of diagnosis and therapy. And I think this is another area, just to kind of flag this. This is another area where foot qi is not unique or exceptional. This kind of debate among different kinds of healers about whether some diseases adhere to particular regions or people from particular regions, and whether therefore there are regional ways of treating them. That's a much broader debate in late imperial China, and foot qi is just one of the instances where we see it playing out.
Awesome. Thank you, Hillary. So here, as we move to chapter 6, we have the story of the rise of beriberi in Asia and an account of how foot qi and the vitamin deficiency disorder came to be equated in 19th century Japan. So as we go to chapter 6, we move to Meiji Japan. Now, we also here see a transformation in foot qi from a dietary disease that was associated with excess and affluence to beriberi, which is associated with the poor and institutionalized, as the chapter indicates, and also from a disease of excess to a vitamin deficiency disorder. So in Japan, now we're talking about kake, the Japanese pronunciation of foot qi, and this is the disease that practitioners of Western medicine came to define as being caused by ingesting too little of dietary vitamin B1 or thiamine. Okay, so conceptually here, this chapter is doing a really important kind of work because it's arguing that the story of how kake acquired its modern dictionary definition as beriberi is not a story of discovery, right? This is not a triumphalist, and finally, they came to the right answer.
Hooray!
Right? It's not. It's importantly not that. It's a story of creation instead. So, Hillary, can you talk a little bit about the importance of that distinction for you as a historian, and also about the conditions here that created or enabled the creation of this disease category?
So I think that distinction is really fundamental to what I'm trying to do in the book overall. If this chapter, since it is really about the origin of modern understandings of Foot Chi, this is the one I think that is the most kind of explicitly contrarian in talking about the identification between Foot Chi, or in the Japanese pronunciation Kake, and beriberi as a creative act rather than one of discovery. In Meiji Japan, what you have, I think, is the convergence of political and economic factors that both create large beriberi epidemics and then also cause those to be interpreted through the lens of Western medicine at that time. So after the Meiji Restoration, particularly in the military in the 1870s, you have significant numbers of soldiers and sailors coming down with beriberi, and the personnel who are assigned to deal with this are largely folks trained in Western medicine. So people like Takaki Kanehiro, who early in his life he had studied Chinese medicine, but most of his training had been in London, and he was a very accomplished practitioner of Western medicine, and thought of Kake very much through the lens of Western medicine and debates within Western medicine. When he saw many cases of Kake in military hospitals, and he had not encountered Kake before in what before the late 19th century had been the more typical context, which would have been individual, generally fairly well-off patients in their own homes. When he saw Kake in the military hospitals, he thought of it through the lens of Western medicine and thought that it might have something to do with an imbalance in diet or nutrition, which for him didn't mean vitamins, because this is late 19th century. This is before the discovery of vitamins, but for him meant an imbalance in protein and carbohydrates and fat. And so he adjusted the diet of sailors in the Imperial Navy with great success, and is therefore celebrated as having helped to relieve Japan from what has sometimes been called the national disease of beriberi in the late 19th century. So this connection that was made between Kake and beriberi, almost nothing except for the name Kake or Foot Chi, is coming from the classical East Asian medical tradition in Meiji Japan. And that has to do with the relative prestige in Meiji Japan of Western medicine and Kampo, Chinese medicine or classical East Asian medicine. Western medicine was the officially recognized form of medicine. It was certainly kind of the first tier of medicine in Meiji Japan. And so it's through that lens that Kake was analyzed and was talked about. I think I've gone a little bit off of what your original question was.
No, not at all. This is great. I think we, to kind of bring us back to the chapter does a really clear job, I think, of bringing us into the conditions that enabled the creation of this, right? And you talk about the modernization of the Japanese military, and which is epidemiological, but also epistemological concerns, right? So, or conditions. So reforms of healthcare and the educational system that gave Western style medical doctors the authority to kind of have the word, right? Or the not maybe not the last word, but an authoritative word on public health problems. So I think that the chapter does so much more than we have time to talk about. But for you, is there anything like particularly important about these conditions and the history that you're showing here that you would really want listeners to understand when they came away from this chapter?
The point is that it's not as though doctors like Takaki Kanehiro came along and pointed out, oh, hey, this kake that people have been writing about for centuries, this is actually beriberi, and now we understand that it has something to do with imbalance in the diet. It's not as though then. That was a great revelation or a discovery for practitioners mm-hmm. of Kampo, right? This was basically a solution to an immediate problem of the late 19th century that because of the epistemological context of Meiji Japan, as you mentioned, then was kind of exaggerated to cover all of the history of Kampo or Chinese medicine.
And there's a lot of really interesting detail in this chapter too that we won't have a chance to talk about, but I just want to flag for listeners about the different waves of kake that affect these transformations. And so there's an account of a wave in the 17th century and then the late 19th century. So this wasn't just like a moment where boom, now, they understand it. You're really showing, I think, the richness and the depth of the historical transformations that happen over time that bring about this creation of this new disease category. Now, this brings us to chapter 7, and there's so much more in here, right, that I want to talk to you about, but at the very least, we have to get to athlete's foot, I think. So I'll situate us a little bit. So chapter 7, in the words of the book, looks at how the modernizing elite in early 20th century China accepted this Japanese reinterpretation of foot qi as beriberi, and how most Chinese people with little experience of beriberi actually reject that definition. And instead favor a definition of athlete's foot. Okay, so the chapter is really clear, and I want to make this clear in the conversation for listeners, that there's no like hard and fast, this nation does this, this nation does that, right? So this is not a story that essentializes anything. And in fact, it's working to destabilize that. At the same time, what it does is it shows us really interesting tendencies that differ in the PRC, in Japan, in Korea, in Taiwan, around how this disease concept is understood today. And that's not just about nation versus nation. It's also, as you show, a matter of looking at different kinds of communities in each of these different contexts. Okay, so to make that, just having made that really clear, right? One of the striking things here is, of course, the athlete's foot thing. So Hillary, how do we get athlete's foot in this context, in the PRC in particular, and what's important about that for you?
Yeah, so athlete's foot is actually, it seems, not a new understanding of foot qi, but when it's among the large basket of things that have meant foot qi over the course of Chinese history. And if you look in pre-modern Chinese sources, you can find case histories, you can find illustrations that focus on symptoms that that are sort of skin symptoms, perhaps something like athlete's foot, like tinea pedis. So it's there, and it was there all along, but it's largely been ignored in formal histories of foot qi. Now, why? So if you're in the People's Republic of China and you talk to people about foot qi, or you look for foot qi, what you're going to find is complaints and discussions about itching feet and stinky feet, and sort of the terrible nuisance that is athlete's foot. So how did it come to be that is the most prominent meaning among in a kind of colloquial setting in China? Although, as you note, it varies depending on education and the field of training of the person that you're talking to in the PRC, but sort of generally this colloquial meaning of athlete's foot. How did that come to be so prominent? In the chapter, I argue that because beriberi was never a disease of kind of nation-threatening importance in China, as it was in Japan. It was never known as the national disease. And there were, sort of scattered beriberi outbreaks in China in the late 19th and early 20th centuries. But it never sort of consumed state attention or the attention of prestigious physicians in the way that it did in Japan. So because there weren't these kinds of major beriberi epidemics, that meaning of foot qi never became kind of broadly meaningful to people in China, even though for the modernizing elite in Republican China in the early 20th century, it was very important to accept the beriberi translation as part of kind of the package of modern understandings of science and medicine that were being assimilated from Japan by, for example, the Kuomintang's Ministry of Health, right? So it was very important in a symbolic sense to accept that foot qi was beriberi. But for most people, that meaning just wasn't, it wasn't something that meant a lot to them personally. And so the athlete's foot meaning was something that continued to have resonance for people in China.
Hillary, thank you so much. So with that, this actually brings us to the conclusion of our conversation. I want to flag for listeners, there's also a conclusion to the book that we won't have time to talk about, but that does a really great job bringing us back to not just the main through lines of the story, but also some of the major conceptual points about the history of disease and what we're doing as historians when we investigate disease historically. And it's just really, really useful. So I just want to flag that for listeners. So Hillary, there's a whole lot, obviously, that we didn't have a chance to talk about. Is there anything in particular that you'd like to put on the table for listeners, and perhaps especially for listeners who haven't yet had the opportunity to become readers?
I guess one thing that I would like to emphasize is that I think this book, although it is an in-depth study of one disease concept of foot qi, it's really not just about foot qi. And I've mentioned this, I think, in our conversation a little bit before, but it really is in many of these different periods and many of these different transformations representative of what's happening to other disease concepts as well. And this, the idea that that foot qi, that we've lost something, that we've lost some understanding of what foot qi was and what doctors were doing about it. That is something I think that you could say also of tianhua, flowers of heaven, things that get translated now as smallpox, or huoluan, which gets translated now as cholera. I think there are similar kind of losses of depth and meaning that happen in the late 19th and early 20th centuries to other disease concepts. And I think it's really important to keep that loss in mind now, because now is a time when many concepts from traditional Chinese medicine are being sort of standardized in their translation. There are lots of different organizations, WHO, the official organization in the PRC that deals with translation of Chinese medicine. There are lots of organizations that are trying to establish a kind of standard terminology for Chinese medicine. And I think if we're not aware of what potentially is being lost in choosing a translation that comes from the late 19th or the early 20th century, for example, that could actually impact what we can learn from Chinese medicine that's clinically applicable today.
That's really, really important. So thank you for highlighting that in the conversation. And now that the book is out, and congratulations on the book, what's next for you, Hillary? What are you working on now?
So since the book, I'm still interested in the history of nutrition science. So as I said, this started out as a study of changes in concept of nutrition, and I'm still interested in that. So what I'm looking at doing next is something like a China-centered history of nutrition science. So there's a kind of typical story about the development of nutrition science, which is that, there are all of these amazing experiments going on, mostly in European and American laboratories in the late 19th and early 20th centuries, that give us kind of the building blocks of modern concepts of nutrition, like calories and vitamins and things like that. And that those concepts then displaced older understandings of sustenance and nutrition. And I think the story is more complicated like that, and more complicated than that. And particularly when you look at the Chinese context, there are lots of ways in which Chinese bodies and Chinese ideas resisted and complicated the development of these sort of universal nutritional concepts in modern nutritional science. So as an example, in the early 20th century, there were recommendations that milk, fresh milk, was a kind of universally healthy, good element of modern diets. And it was discovered much later in the 1960s that, in fact, a huge proportion of the global population, something like 75%, is lactose intolerant. And in China, the rates of lactose intolerance are typically like 80% or more. And so consuming fresh milk can actually make people feel uncomfortable and sick. And so there are ways in which the recommendations of nutritional science, which kind of purported to be universal, really were built originally on the bodies of subjects of Western European descent and turned out not to be so universal. And then also in terms of ideas, in Republican China, there are lots of ideas about what you should eat in order to be healthy that coexist with and are in communication with these new scientific ideas about calories and vitamins and so forth. So things like Buddhist vegetarianism or ideas about hot and cold qualities of food, which are kind of a traditional understanding of how to balance a diet. These things are they're not separate from nutritional scientific ideas. People are consuming, no pun, but consuming all of these ideas together and kind of synthesizing them. And so I want to kind of complicate that history of nutrition science by considering these complications and these contributions, I think, that Chinese bodies and Chinese ideas made to ideas about healthy modern diets.
Well, best of luck with that project, which also sounds super, super important, Hillary. And thanks for taking time away from that research to talk with me about this book. It's really been a pleasure.
Thank you so much. I enjoyed it.
You've been listening to New Books in East Asian Studies. Thanks so much for listening, and have a good day.